get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
All right, welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have Ted Kubitis. Now, if you don't know who Ted has been in the SEO game since the very beginning. So he's seen it evolve all the way through and essentially as things developed with Google as well. So we cover a bunch of things that he's been testing. So he's big on essentially scientific testing as part of his SEO strategy. And we cover topics such as, should you do your meta description? And if so, how? Ideas on keyword density, if Core Web Vitals was a ranking factor. And we also dive into the actual Google itself and where he believes Google's heading in the future and how you can future-proof yourself from any changes there. He also has his own software that helps him measure essentially search volatility and the things happening within Google, which is Core. And you can go in the description. There should be a link down there to that as well. But sit back and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
All right. Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today, we have a legend in the SEO space, Ted Kubitis. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. I think I've mentioned it in multiple Niche Website Builders podcasts. I've been listening to SEO Fight Club and referring back to this every now and then. So it's great to have you on to be able to talk to you in person and not just have to listen to you on YouTube.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm glad to be here.
So for anyone who isn't maybe familiar with you and your background, do you want to provide a brief background of who you are and what you've been up to?
I have several storylines in parallel. My SEO story is that I was hired out of college to work at Microsoft in their marketing department doing computer science type projects in marketing. They actually had me working for a literal rocket scientist in their marketing group who was part of the engineering team for the Boeing Delta II. And so their concept in this little think tank was, let's hire rocket scientists and throw marketing problems at them and see what comes out. And so I was part of the engineering team that the rocket scientists had. And this was way back in the .com era. Prior to that, I was part of the NCSA Mosaic team, or not the Mosaic team, but NCSA Software Tools Group, which had the Mosaic team with Mark Andreessen, had the office across the hall from him. He would later make Netscape. So that was a lot of words basically saying I go all the way back to the beginning. So I saw the whole evolution of web browsers and the web and the birth of SEO and the whole evolution of SEO. So I've seen the whole thing, and I was in the right places to, you know, be a part of of a lot of that. And so I was mainly a software engineer, and eventually I found my way into a large online retailer doing web development. And I realized pretty quickly that if I did things to the website, we would get a lot of organic traffic and boost sales. So I worked in isolation for about 17 years without nobody knowing me as an SEO, creating scripts and learning about SEO on my own. And eventually I started showing people on Black Hat World some of my data. So I said, you know, hey, you know, I ran this report on a keyword and I found these factors appear to be important. And all of a sudden, everybody jumped on me. What tool gave you that data? And so from there, my company was born. When I was at the online retailer, I had a basic premise of scientific method in doing the SEO I was doing. I was experimenting. We had 15 stores. I was experimenting on the smallest store, and whatever victories I'd have on that smallest store, I'd propagate those strategies to the other 14. And it took, geez, maybe 6 months for me to go from a peon web developer all the way to director of business intelligence with a seat at the executive table. So, you know, to the moon, just using basic scientific method and testing SEO before deploying it where it's most needed. And so that strategy, very powerful if you're trying to climb the corporate ladder. So I did that largely in secrecy for 17 years. Then I left that to start my software tools company and to just keep, you know, researching SEO. So I'm part of a think tank of SEO testers who try to use scientific method just to get to the truth of the matter.
Awesome. Yeah, that's what I also love about your little podcast as well. Obviously, you guys test a lot and have data to back up kind of what you're trying to portray.
And peer review, because boy, does Clint Pepper tell me I'm full of shit when when things get sketchy in my work. Peer review is it. You know, it's not science without the peer review.
No, exactly. I actually wanted to start. I have a whole bunch of stuff to ask you based on things you've talked about before, but you obviously mentioned e-com. That's kind of where you spend a lot of your time. And I guess the audience listening to this are mainly in the display ad affiliate space, kind of going down that road with their blog, but obviously there might be people branching out into e-commerce as well. I guess, are there any key differences between e-commerce SEO versus just a typical blog or affiliate blog SEO?
Well, I'm always super impressed by the people who are successful in affiliate SEO. That to me is like the hardest hurdle to jump. So if you're succeeding in affiliate, that's absolutely amazing. Kudos to you. If you're struggling with affiliate to make it work as a lifestyle, don't feel bad. It is literally the hardest thing to do in SEO. Now, the key difference between the two isn't an SEO consideration. It's actually separate. And the reason I have a hard time with affiliate SEO is I end up looking at the affiliate offers going, well, shit, you know, I can get 4% from Amazon per sale, but the sale is the hard part of this whole thing. So, you know, that's kind of terrible. If I can source the same product out of China for 25 cents each and sell them with free shipping in the United States for 20 bucks a pop, you know, I can take home 75, 80% for getting the sale.
Yeah.
And so I find myself very quickly trying to source and get the better percentage because, you know, 80% beats the heck out of 4%. And so I find it very hard to be motivated by that 4% commission. Yeah. And so I think affiliate, you know, the first problem is how do you make the numbers work? You know, one of the cool things about affiliate is they give you the numbers up front so you can work it all out in a spreadsheet and figure out what you need to do to pay your bills with this type of model. And it's very hard. It's very hard. So the other thing is that Google in the past has had a bias against affiliate. And you see it in their statements. They say, well, if you have affiliate pages and you offer no extra value to people coming to your website than the same product information that's everywhere, why should we rank that? You know, they make statements like that that are literally, if you're an affiliate site, we're going to push you down. You need to be something more than that to succeed, and that's coming out of their own language and their own statements. But SEOs need to hear that. That's a bias. And so there's this long history of cloaking your affiliate links and making plausible content to differentiate and trying to spin the manufacturer descriptions. And there's just so many things. And then on top of that, you get the affiliate websites, the places that are going to pay you for the sales. They have their own rules as to what you can and can't do. And so some places will say you can't cloak the affiliate link, or you can't email these offers, or you can't. And all of those things are handcuffs that make it harder and harder. But, you know, the good news is that if you manage to solve all those other problems, the SEO part is kind of straightforward. So in order to rank, you just need the right keyword density. You need the right number of like referring domains and backlinks to have authority to be competitive. You need good factor diversity so you don't get, you know, algorithmically demoted for not having enough diversity. And you need your entities so you get classified to be relevant to the topic. And so if you can do those things and they're kind of straightforward, then your affiliate pages, just like any other page, should rank. You know, the one thing I would add to that is, you know, you probably want to make it difficult for Google to apply a bias against you for having affiliate links. And there are a number of plugins and stuff that help you cloak your affiliate links, but definitely check with your affiliate program before you do that, because they might not allow it.
It's one of those like pretty links that turns into like your URL forward slash whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and you know, you have to read everything carefully, because technically there's a lot of gray area, because the modern web is built on cloaking. When you switch a desktop site responsively to a mobile site, in most cases, you're cloaking parts of the desktop site to do that. You're saying, oh, well, in this mobile view, we won't show this section. Well, that section is still in the source. It's just hidden on the mobile view. You're cloaking it for mobile. So there's all kinds of things like that that are gray areas. And from an engineering side, there's usually a lot of techniques you can do to stay on the edge of the rules without, you know, strictly violating them. Yeah. And they call that gray hat. And so part of the art is figuring out how far you can push the rules without violating them.
Gotcha. I'm going to throw a harder question at you. You mentioned about Google has this bias against affiliate. I know you've talked about, I think you've
They've had it in the past.
So now
they claim to not have it now, but their statements are still, if you're just an affiliate page with nothing better to offer, why should we rank you? That sounds to me like bias against affiliate pages. But we don't know for certain.
Which is interesting, because you still see thin affiliate pages ranking on the first page of Google. It's almost like they say these things, but maybe it's not being taken into account with their actions as such. I guess why do you think that is?
Well, you know, to start, thin doesn't mean spam. So you got to keep in mind that there are naturally occurring thin pages that are super important. Like your primary, you know, software download page.
Yeah.
It, you know, its purpose is a download link. You know, it doesn't need to have all the documentation on it. You know, that might be a thin page. An e-com category page is, you know, historically a thin page. So thin doesn't necessarily mean bad or spammy, but it comes with its own problem set. And so for affiliate pages, you know, they tend not to be thin. When I see somebody's affiliate page, they're going to have the manufacturer description. They're going to have, you know, typically review blocks. They're going to have, you know, other information, oftentimes all the way to the point of being a skyscraper content piece.
Yeah.
You know, they could be quite large. And there's usually a lot of unique sales offers or unique ideas on how to use it or why to use it. You know, so, you know, I don't necessarily think that affiliate pages in general are thin, and I don't necessarily think that thin pages are bad either.
Gotcha.
In fact, you might want different types of affiliate pages, some being more skyscraper, some being thin. Then no matter which way the algorithm goes, you have something out there to rank. And that's usually a good strategy, is to diversify your approaches and see what's working and be set up so that if the landscape changes, you have something covering that possibility too.
Gotcha. You've mentioned already on this podcast about keyword density. Now, obviously, keyword density is almost poo-pooed within the space as keyword stuffing, as in, oh, I can't use the exact match keyword too many times. I'm going to over-optimize, as people say. So I guess, is there a keyword density that is too much? What's the threshold? Is it even an important ranking factor to have a certain percentage keyword density versus maybe someone else on the SERPs?
Well, in testing, what we'll do is we'll create a bunch of pages and they'll have escalating keyword density from 2% keyword density all the way up to 95% keyword density. And when we successfully execute that test, what Google does is they sort those pages in descending order of keyword density.
So 95% as in 95, just repeating 90. The same keyword over and over and over again, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that's exact match keyword density too. Okay. It'll go 95%, 90, 85, 80, and you'll just see in the rankings, you know, they sort it by keyword density descending. Now, it's not that simple. That's not the only factor.
Yeah.
But when you isolate just to that factor only on your test pages, Google sorts by the only thing you give it, which is that density. But when you get out into the field, it gets more chaotic because backlinks matter and your relevancy matters and your diversity matters and they have different weightings. And so keyword density ends up being, you know, a smaller part of the puzzle, but it is a part of the puzzle.
Gotcha.
And there's a few kinds of keyword density we work with, one of which is that exact match. The other kind is the variation density. These are the words that in Google desktop search that they're making bold. So if you type in plumber, it'll say, you know, plumber, plumbers, plumbing, things of that nature and other closely related synonyms. And it'll highlight those words bold. So we like to collect those words and measure them everywhere they occur. And it's that variation density that seems to be the most powerful thing to compete on.
Mm.
So getting your density of that list of bolded terms to a competitive level seems to be the thing. And so people have a lot of success working with that. Now, the other thing with keyword density is most SEOs aren't going to do it. I mean, it's hard to do, and SEOs like an easy button. Keyword density is just a little bit beyond what most SEOs are willing to do. So if you can treat it like an experiment and prove to yourself that it works, odds are none of your competitors are going to use it against you. And they will accidentally in making a skyscraper, but they're not going to watch it and say, I'm going to get 1% more than you.
Yeah.
And so for a lot of people, you can take the advantage just by treating it like an experiment and proving it for yourself.
So then I shouldn't be, I guess, worried or scared that I'm going to get penalized if I use my exact match or variations of it too much than an article?
Well, the most important question in SEO is, if they can do it, why can't I? And the truth behind that question is there's a reason why they can and you can't. And it turns out more and more as we test and explore these issues, it looks like diversity is the answer.
Okay.
So if the only thing you have is keyword density and you don't have any other factors, then there are web spam algorithms, one of which is called MC4, and we believe Google is using something very similar to MC4, which says if you're exploiting a minority of factors, the algorithm just won't count those. And you see it when people spam backlinks. They say, I'll get some backlinks and, you know, woohoo, my page went up, so I'll get a few hundred more backlinks. Yeah, I went up more. This is awesome. Let's get a few thousand backlinks. Yeah, this is great. We're really, you know, topping the charts. Now let's get 50,000 backlinks. And then their site tanks. Well, it's not that they got penalized necessarily. They could have, but it's unlikely. What happened is they got an algorithmic demotion because that MC4 algorithm said the only factor they're using is backlinks, so we just won't count it. Mm-hmm. And then they fall back to where they were without it. And then what people often do is the wrong thing in responding to it. They say, oh, well, I need to clean up my backlinks. I did too many. I need to clean them all up. When really what they need to do is diversify their ranking signals. Because there's nothing wrong with having 50,000 backlinks. Lots of websites have a lot more than 50,000 backlinks. And if they can do it, why can't I? And so there's got to be a reason. And that reason is diversify. So if you tune your entities and your LSI keywords and your keyword density, and you make sure that, you know, you have a broad diversity of ranking signals, then you just rank well. And you can go to a keyword, you can test this out in the field in Google. You can go to a keyword like games, go to the number one ranked website, view source, and see how many times the keyword game is used on that page. I bet it's in the hundreds.
Yeah.
And that's a page. So if you come into that keyword, I made a cool designed web page with, you know, totally original quality content, and I use my keyword 23 times. Are you going to compete against a page that uses it 750? And there's just a reality. We all don't like it. You know, of course, my article that I spent, you know, hours writing and the graphics I spent hours designing is better quality. But that's not how Google works. Sadly, it's just not how they work. And the testing is time and time proved that again. Like Kyle Roof, you've probably heard of him.
Yep, I had him on a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he's famous for doing lorem ipsum testing, where he'd tune pages with Latin boilerplate, and he'd tune the keyword density and the entities and the factor diversity, and he'd rank things to number one with it. He does that word math and tunes gibberish and gets it to the top of Google. And what that does is it proves that Google isn't reading your content. They're not saying, oh, you made a great point in paragraph two. You know, that's just not how it works. And if you think about it, there's over 200 trillion URLs in Google's database. They can't possibly read that content in that way.
Yeah.
Even with the smartest AI, you know, they'll apply the AI to your keyword searches. They'll apply the AI to the best content they find, but they're not going to apply the AI to everything because it's just not cost effective to do it.
Yeah. Gotcha. Now that makes sense. I also wanted to touch on, you obviously mentioned ranking factors within that too. And I wanted to touch on meta descriptions because myself, I'm just lazy. I don't bother writing them. And I guess a lot of, like you just say, courses and talk nowadays talk about don't bother doing meta descriptions because Google just picks it and fills it out. And they pick the best meta description for your page. So I want to know your thoughts and opinions. Should you write them? And then if you do, how should you write them?
It's a trap. All right. Here's the trap. Google is going, they're right that Google will select something on the page and use it. The problem is Google will often split test different phrases on the page. And we've measured it, we've witnessed it, we've recorded it. Google split testing will have, you know, oh, if Google picked description one and you're ranking at spot number three, but then they pick script number or description number two and you're now ranking at spot number 12. And they'll go back and forth, and as they switch out those descriptions, your rankings will be volatile between spot number three and spot number 12. And that's a lot of volatility for a page. And then you take a website like business.com, who is doing exactly this. They have a few hundred thousand pages, and none of them have the meta description, and they all have this volatility. By ignoring the meta description, you've added just a huge amount of ranking volatility site-wide, because you've abdicated the problem. And they say that, you know, oh, well, Google's not going to pick yours. Well, you're right in that a web page will rank for a lot of keywords, and they're going to pick something that's relevant for the keyword being searched.
Yeah.
But usually for any given page, there is a most important keyword. There is a target keyword that you feel this page needs to win. All the others are icing on the cake, but this primary target keyword is the most important one. And that's the one you ought to be tuning your meta description for.
Okay.
And so you're right that you won't win the meta description on all keywords, but you ought to win it on the most important keyword. And the other problem with that belief system, oh, Google's testing it and they'll pick the one that works best. Yeah, they will. They'll pick the one that works best for Google. Not the one that necessarily works best for your page. They're not picking the one that makes you rank the best. That's not what they're doing. And we see it when Google's testing ends, more than half the time they're picking the one that ranks you lower. So if you let Google choose, you're probably going to end up in spot 12 when you could have been in spot 3.
Just from a simple meta description, you can have that huge of a, I guess, ranking change.
Yeah. And so it's important to get them to pick it. Now, the problem is it's very hard to get Google to pick the text you want them to pick. So it's going to take some trial and error to be able to take control. There are some tricks, though, because Google favors certain types of things. And one of the things they favor right now is numbered lists, where you're doing the numbered list entries in headings, in H2 and H3 tags. Mm. So if your page is the top 25 jQuery plugins, if you have a heading that's, you know, one dot, you know, name of first plugin, and then a heading that's two dot name of second plugin, doing that is very powerful. Google, most of the time, will concatenate those headings in the list and automatically form that to be your description text. And so if you're clever about using those numbered lists, you can control that text. Not just in getting the text you want there to rank, but you can put CRO back into the meta description. You can say, you know, the five reasons you should buy this product. Number one, free shipping today. Number two, save 35%. Number three, it's in stock. You know, number four, you're getting your CRO into that meta description where people would likely be influenced by it for a purchase decision. And so there are clever ways to exploit, you know, things like that.
Nice. So then how would you write that meta description for more of an informational style page? Is there some kind of like keywords you're trying to pick out to put in there?
Well, you want it to be relevant. It seems like the most important consideration Google has for what they're choosing to use is the relevancy of the text for the keyword. So you do have to work the keyword in there, usually more than once. But it doesn't have to be the exact match. It needs to be those variations that they make bold in search. Yeah. So you do have some latitude to make it look more natural by using different keyword variations, but they need to be in there, and oftentimes more than one. So you got to be competitive for your keyword.
So like maybe a really crude example might be like, if you have a page on best golf clubs, it might be, these are the best golf clubs for blah, 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 and this is why these golf clubs are the best or something. And that's kind of getting it in twice, but slightly different.
Yeah. And there is a filter on using your exact match too much in the title of the page. We don't know about the meta description right now. So if you search for a keyword like games without any special modifiers, you'll see it appear as much as four times in the title, but you'll never see it appear five. And if you put it in a quoted search, you'll see that those pages are out there. They're just not going to be in the primary index for the keyword. So there are filters that Google has that can kick you out. From what we've seen, we don't know of one in the meta description yet. Historically, emojis in the meta description would kick you out, but I don't think that's true anymore. Title is more of a sticky spot.
Gotcha. I wanted to shift to another, I guess, perceived ranking factor as well. I guess we're going to run through a few of the myths before I actually want to jump more into the SERPs as well. But Core Web Vitals, obviously that was a huge scare a year ago now. People were trying to remove plugins and all sorts from their page to speed their website up. I know you've done some testing on it based on some stuff I've watched of yourself. Do you want to maybe dive into, one, is Core Web Vitals a ranking factor? Two, do you even need to worry about it? And if so, when should you worry about it?
Well, I've seen Clint Butler's study. He did a fairly exhaustive study on it. I've done my own study on it. I've seen Lee Witcher's study on it. And we have a bunch of measurement data from the rankings themselves for things that are ranking in the field. And all of those things agree that Core Web Vitals doesn't appear to help you rank in any way. So if you're doing Core Web Vitals for rankings, you're probably going to look bad to your employer or client at the end of that project. It's probably not going to yield a good return for that KPI. Now, are there reasons you would want to do it? Yes, they tend to be more CRO. If your website is responsive and easy to use, you should see that affect your conversion rate. So on the part of the puzzle that's getting that human being at the bus stop to buy your product while it's on sale, Core Web Vitals can matter there. But page speed in general, like how fast your website is, it's also not a ranking factor. Like it is in the most extreme sense, like if it's taking you 30 seconds to load a page, that's going to hurt you.
Yeah.
But if your page speed is, you know, anywhere between 0 and 8 seconds, I mean, it's not a factor. Like Google does not differentiate rankings based on that. What it is a filter. So, and it's hard for people to understand this, but imagine somebody being out at the bus stop, they're on their phone, they get an email from you about your latest offers, they click on the URL, and it takes forever for that page to load because it's over 4G network connection, it's super slow, it's miserable. That marketing email campaign is going to be abysmal for the 4G connection on a mobile device. And so Google is looking at that data as well, going, I shouldn't serve a web page that's got a heavy page weight like that for somebody at the bus stop. So what they do is they filter those results. They don't rank them lower, they just filter them. And as a result, if your page is slow, you appear in fewer searches. So when you fix that problem, you don't rank higher, you appear in more searches. You get more people standing at the bus stop finding your website. Gotcha. So you won't see it. You won't see the ROI in rankings. You'll see the ROI in organic traffic. And so if you're not watching that, you'll miss some victories you have in your SEO because you can do all of that page speed improvement, not change a single ranking, but 10x your traffic.
Interesting.
And so it's important to watch the two, not just rankings, but organic traffic from search.
Gotcha. Now that's a really good analogy to use it, like a good explanation of it as well. Just the idea of being it slow and Google just filtering results based on someone's like, I mean, they have all that information anyway. They track almost everything.
Yeah. Your ranking, you know, when you're getting fewer searches will still be the same ranking when you use your rank tracker. You won't see a difference based on that. And so it's important as an SEO that you give people the right reasons for doing things. And so many SEOs say, you know, we need to tune our page speed so we get better rankings. And then at the end of that, they look bad. It was worth doing, but they set the wrong goalpost.
Gotcha.
You know, they should have said we need to work on page speed so we optimize our conversion rate and our search traffic. And then they look like a hero. You know, it just don't claim that the result will be something that it's not. And that's kind of a tricky spot in SEO.
Yeah, for sure. I actually want to, I guess we cover more on the website side, but I want to take this a little bit towards Google side. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you really don't like Google. Is that correct?
I don't dislike them. I think some of what they do is completely unnecessary. Like Google invented this whole culture of penalties. It didn't exist before Google. You have the freedom to sell links on your website if you wanted to. That's how a lot of websites were monetized. There were a lot of stay-at-home moms doing affiliate website to supplement their income. There were schools doing it to supplement the school funding. You know, it's weird that, you know, Google made this culture of penalties that really gave us less choice and freedom. You know, now everybody's afraid to link to their friends because will it be spam? You know, but isn't that kind of free speech online? Can I link to my buddies? Don't I have that freedom?
Not if they ask. Not if they ask you.
Well, there's a lot of things that I think Google should not be doing, because I think the web before Google was just better for us. Like the post-Google web doesn't feel better. It feels like we as website owners lost a lot in that deal. And so, you know, I think that's my main gripe with Google, is they didn't make the world better.
They
might have made, you know, search better at the time. It's arguably not better now.
It's not so good.
But it, you know, they didn't make the world a better place, and they got rid of their "Don't be evil" motto, which I felt was a rare moment of honesty. I used to be a Google fanboy. I really loved them in the early days. I set up my grandparents to use Google when it was brand new. I was really excited by it. It was amazing. But they slowly earned the, you know, discontent I have for them now. But I have nothing personal against them. Like, I've met Paul Haar on their search team. I think he's wonderful. I think John Mueller's a really nice guy. I love that he's helping people, even though I don't think all of his information is correct. But I think his heart is in the right place. And I think Google, in general, when you look at the search team, most of them want to help and they want to make things better. But I think they need to change their rules. I think they should say, do whatever you want. It's your website. If you need to hustle to pay payroll and to keep your doors open, we're not going to punish you on top of that. It sounds like you have enough going on. You know, they should just get rid of the culture of penalties. Now, they can caveat whatever you're trying, it might not and probably won't work. But we're not going to penalize you for trying to survive, or, you know, doing a Hail Mary in a time of crisis, you know, because that's not what Google is supposed to be there for. Nobody wanted them to be the internet police, and I think they suck at it too. So they should get rid of that aspect of who they are and just say, you know, do what you want. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't. Can't make any promises, but just know we're not out to get you anymore.
Yeah. But before I dive into actual the SERP itself, what will it take for another company to take a market share from Google? For example, obviously you've got Bing that gets some searches. You've got Ahrefs just released their search engine. What's it going to take for someone to start taking over Google?
Google's primary index is getting smaller and smaller. And the way you measure that is you go search for a keyword and figure out exactly how many results they will show you before they stop giving you results, the actual number of results. And, you know, you put in most keywords nowadays and it's under 200 results. It's not a lot. Like, it used to be 1,000. So if they keep shrinking that, you know, that's a problem, you know, and that means fewer websites get to be in search, to be findable in a naturally intuitive way. And so if nobody's getting any service out of Google for their website, then there's an opening for somebody else to come in and deliver traffic to the websites. And then all of a sudden, everybody's going to evangelize. As a website owner, I'm going to say, hey, grandma, use this search engine because they help pay my bills. And I think this is the best search engine ever. And that's how Google started. That's exactly Google's playbook when they came on the scene. And so they're creating a situation where somebody else can come on the scene and offer value to websites, and then the evangelism will all sway away from Google. And I always thought that Bing should have come out and rejected Google's culture of penalties. They should have said, you know, we don't penalize, we don't believe in that. You do what you need to do to survive. As long as it's not breaking any laws, we don't care. You know, they should have taken that stance and then done a big campaign on all the traffic they're driving to organic websites. You know, find, you know, case studies of people who optimized for Bing and the results they got and the value it was to their business. Because there's a lot of opportunity in Bing if you're a U.S. or Canada, you know, business. International, not so much, you know, hear people on that. But, you know, there's a lot of traffic there. For like a U.S. Online retailer, it could be as high as 25 to 35% of your organic revenue. And for a, you know, multi-million dollar company, that's a big chunk of change. So yeah, you know, there's room. And the interesting thing is people are like, oh, well, you'll never get, you know, 90% market share to beat Google. You don't need it. Because the second you get close, even close to 50%, you get 35, 40%, 42%. That's really the barrier, because then you're looking at this 42, 48, and that's equivalency. Now you get SEO saying, hey, I got to treat these the same. And that's the flipping point. So the benchmark to beat Google isn't getting the most market share. It's just getting as close as you can to 50%, where everybody has to start saying, wow, these things are the same to my bottom line. I need to treat them with equal respect.
Gotcha.
And the other problem with the search engine war is that there may not be room in it for multiple players. Because the default problem with human beings is they don't want to go to places to do one thing. So even though, you know, there are other options, people are just ingrained to go to one, and that's the one. So it might be, in terms of search engines, that it's always a monopoly situation. And if it's always a monopoly situation, then we just kind of need to recognize that and set some rules.
Yeah. Gotcha. I guess the question becomes then, say, let's just say, for example, Bing is the new search engine, even though it's not, because it's obviously been around for a while. But how do you tune or rank your page on Bing? Is there something that you can or need to do to almost favor that search engine?
Yeah. In many ways, Bing is easier than Google. They're simpler. You know, your keyword matters more, your exact match matters more. Bing is really fussy though. So if you have problems in Bing Webmaster Tools, you need to address them, because Bing will hold a grudge against you for any problems you have. So if you have multiple H1s, or if you have 500 errors some of the time, or your page goes 404, Bing has instant problems with anything like that. So you got to be careful to not have issues. The other thing Bing wants is you need at least one backlink that Bing knows about. So if it's a brand new page with no backlinks, it's going to have a hard time getting indexed in Bing. The third thing that people don't realize about Bing Webmaster Tools is their crawl rate by default is extremely slow. So if you don't go in and max it out, they're going to crawl one page a week.
So you
need to understand that setting and note that the default will get you there in a year or two. But you have to escalate those settings in order to get fast indexation.
How do you do that? Is that just a setting in the Webmaster Tools, or do you need to do something else?
Yeah. They let you set the crawl rate on various days, and the default is just really slow. So if you want it to be indexed quickly, you got to max out that crawl rate.
Gotcha. I want to come back to Google now as well. Obviously, recently, we've had the helpful content update. Now they just announced another core update as well. Have you seen, anything change or anything that you've observed with the current core update or anything with the previous helpful content update?
That's a good question. Let me take a look at some data before I answer that. So I'm going to a website called topseofactors.com, which has the top correlating factors for the day, and it's updated daily. So I'm seeing diversity near the top, so number of factors used. We see a lot of enterprise technology services near the top, and those correlate with basically enterprise authority websites. It's not that the technology helps you rank, it's that, you know, big websites that rank well can afford the technology. Let's see, we see a lot of diversity in entities, diversity in LSI mattering. Those are at the top of the list, and those have been at the top for a long time. We see relevancy statistics, so your variations and headings, your entities and the title tag. So
a lot of the same stuff then.
Yeah. But it's there's a little bit of a shakeup. You'll see micro movements from these updates where, authority goes down a little and exact match goes up a little. You know, it won't be huge amounts. They're like minor shifts to the weighting of these types of factors. And you have to keep in mind that we're looking at a list that's like the top 200 of like 7,000 possible factors. So if you move from number 13 down to number 75, you're still at the top of the top, 7,000 factors. They're just, changes in weighting. But typically what's been working well for everyone is having authority primarily in the form of referring domains. So make sure you're competitive on that first and foremost. Then relevancy, having the right exact match and variations and entities and LSI on page. Density, making sure that your page is more about those important things than other topics. And then diversity, making sure that you have a very wide breadth of different factors and ranking signals so that you don't trigger web spam algorithms. And so that when Google says, I'm going to decrease backlinks and increase exact match, you see no change at all because you had them both dialed in. So typically on these updates, when people say, I got hit hard by it, it's because they had a lot of factor A and almost none of factor B. And then Google's algorithm favored factor B. And then it's like, whoa, I fell. It's because Google is taking all these signals and they calculate them into a simple ranking score. And then your websites are stacked ranked with your competitors based on those scores. And so, it's not, there's not a human being at Google that's, reading these pages saying, you made an excellent point in paragraph 2. I think you should rank 7th instead of 13th. That's not how it works. It, you know, it's just too big to work that way. But, you know, Google likes being the man behind the curtain, so they're okay if you think that's how it works.
Yeah, I think what's interesting to me as well is something that someone posted on Twitter semi-recently. It was about the helpful content update, and it was, as you mentioned, people thought it might work like this. So the example was given, for example, news sites or Forbes.com ranking for like best car tires, something that's not relevant to the site. And people were thinking, hey, maybe the helpful content update is going to help basically de-rank these news websites because they're not relevant to whatever the term is. Now, obviously, these sites are obviously still ranking on authority. So is this something that, do you believe Google is looking to eventually try and change to have more, I guess, experts or relevant blogs at the top, I guess, within their SERPs?
Well, with the helpful content update specifically, there's a lot of unknowns about it. So the first thing Google said is that it's going to take weeks and months to apply. It's not going to be a fast update. The problem with that is it won't change any behavior. So if you have a dog that's misbehaving and the dog, you know, misbehaves right now, you don't punish them 2 weeks from now. The dog won't know what it did wrong. So, you know, the punishment has to kind of line up with the behavior if Google's goal is to change behavior. And this algorithm is so slow, it can't possibly change behavior in a reasonable amount of time. So it then begs the question, what are they trying to accomplish with it? And so my thought on it is they had something specific in mind that they're trying to clear out of the primary index because they're having problems with scale. And so they wanted to get something they felt was garbage and the primary index out. And so unless you were part of that garbage collection, you probably didn't see a change. The other thing about it is they said that it was going to be a metric for entire sites. Like they're going to calculate a score for the whole site. And so that's why it's going to take a lot of time for it to happen. And so that's new. You know, they didn't claim to have site-wide ranking signals before. So this is them claiming to have one now. And the fact that it's got that nature of being site-wide, they're going to look at all your pages, makes me think that it's for very large sites. So if you are a plumber with a standard 5-page plumber blog or, you know, WordPress site, you know, I suspect that this algorithm is looking for bigger fish. So you may not be affected by the helpful content update at all simply because you have a page count of 5 and they're looking for websites with tens of thousands of pages. So, you know, we have these theories and, you know, time will tell us as we learn more about them and we see who gets impacted and who doesn't. You know, we'll figure this stuff out eventually. Right now, we just have theories that need testing and data. But I do suspect this update is more geared towards very large websites. And so if you have a small website and you haven't seen any change, it probably passed you by.
Nice. Hopefully that's most of the people listening then. Now, I wanted to actually jump into as well, before we finish, on different SERP features. So obviously, Google's always rolling out new Google Shopping banners, YouTube widgets, all sorts of stuff. They've obviously recently released that new 5-minute read, I guess, badge on some of the articles. I guess, what direction do you think Google's kind of going in here and what they're trying to achieve? And how does that affect us as website owners? Is there something that we need to do or change to almost try to keep up?
Well, and it depends what your business model is. So if you're an online retailer, you need to be in those zones because that's where shoppers are clicking. So unfortunately, yeah, you're going to have to play ball and be a multi-channel marketer. But the truth is, you needed to be a multi-channel marketer all along. You know, you get your best business outcome when you're doing SEO and email marketing and social marketing and paid advertising. And, you know, if you leave any of that off the table, you're probably leaving money on the table as well. For online retail, SEO would usually, you know, bring in for a healthy online retailer that's doing multi-channel marketing very well. SEO will be about 15 to 25% of revenue. But if you are over invested in SEO, you'll start seeing things like, you know, organic revenue is 75% of our income. And that's scary because that means Google can come in and do something nasty and basically put you out of business.
Yeah.
And so you probably want to diversify so you're not given that kind of power to Google. And so that's the truth of the matter, is that you probably should have diversified to begin with. Now, what does all these features mean for SEO going forward? Well, we've kind of seen it, all right, the trend. So Google used to have 1,000 results. Now they're down to 168 results. So fewer websites are findable for a keyword. There used to be 10, always 10 organic results on page one. Now there's sometimes 9, sometimes 8. Mm. So everybody lost 10 to 20% of their page one rankings and didn't even know to complain about it.
Yeah, I hate that, because you see like, oh, I'm ranked third, but then you go search, you're actually ranked number one, but you've got like 3 widgets above you and you're halfway down the page.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, ads used to always be in the side. Google swore they'd never commingle ads in the search results. Now they're commingled with the snipe. Mm. And so you got ads above, ads below. Yeah. And if you're on the lazy load as you scroll results, you get ads in the middle too. and then you have, you know, the map pack above you. You have all the information widgets above you. So really, you know, being on page one used to be the thing. But now if you're not in the top three, you know, you're basically page two. Mm. So you really have to compete to a higher standard. So as Google continues to diminish organic web results, the SEO game becomes a more difficult game to play. And then ultimately, you know, the fear we have academically is that as spam begins to take over organic web search, people will lose confidence in organic web search, and that gives Google a license to simply remove it. Mm. And that's why Google's investing heavily in information systems so they can answer inquiries and give correct answers and do this stuff. So there may come a point, you know, not soon, but, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the road, where organic web search is so filled with, you know, generated content that human beings are onto and don't want to read, that whole system becomes pointless and something else needs to take its place. And so I keep thinking, you know, well, what do I do if, you know, that perfect storm ever happens? And so, you know, I have fallback plans of, well, I can work on ranking in whatever replaces organic web search, or I could switch over to pay-per-click.
Hmm.
But, you know, keep in mind that's a doomsday scenario for our industry that is likely not to happen in the current decade.
Yeah, but still possible.
Yeah, you can see the direction. The ever-shrinking primary index, less and less exposure on page one, organic results being pushed further and further down the page and below the fold. You know, these are all signs that Google is moving a direction of deprioritizing the organic web search. So they're trying to say, this is less and less of our business. This is less and less of why you come to our search engine. And then, you know, eventually they'll probably have a great day where they say, we don't need this expensive beast. We can do it without it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, that's the worry down the road is, you know, what's the long-term future of SEO? And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years from now, it was a different world.
Yeah. Before we finish as well, I wanted to circle back a little bit on that, the 5-minute read badge that they've been putting on some posts. Does that mean potentially that we could be going down the road of Google favoring shorter form content? Obviously people were all about long form content. You need to make, you know, cover everything for the reader. Now, obviously they're potentially favoring shorter form content, maybe because of the way, you know, things like TikTok have been done with short form video and things. Is that, I guess, something the way Google's looking to go?
We don't know about their future plans. So yeah. The truth is we have to kind of wait and see. Historically, in the data up to and including today, the best performing strategy is still big pages with keywords throughout.
Mm.
So if you look at the data as of today, that's still a winning approach. But the question is always, you know, what will Google do tomorrow? And nobody but Google really knows that. And so we are playing a game of, you know, at any point in time, Google can change the rules of the whole system. And so we need to be in a place where we can quickly verify what we know is still true. And that if everything changes, that we can relearn SEO quickly. And, you know, fortunately, there's a lot of tools out there, you know, including mine, that help you do exactly that. They can notify you when the landscape changes, and they can help you understand, you know, how and when things changed, by how much, and how to react, and how to learn it over if you're learning for the first time or learning it all again because of major change.
That's a great way to end this podcast too. But is there, I know you're a bit of a ghost online. When I was trying to search, I couldn't find much. So is there a way people can kind of follow what you're doing and maybe find out more information about you?
Yeah. My business is SEOtoollab.com. So if you want to see the technology I make to help SEOs, I strongly recommend checking it out, at least understanding what it is, because you will be competing against it. other thing I would recommend you do is join a group. So being in an SEO group is a great idea because you can, instead of just thinking for yourself, you know, should I do this thing I'm thinking about doing to my website? You can ask, you know, 500 to 1,000 seasoned marketing veterans, hey guys, should I do this thing I'm thinking about doing to my website? And sure enough, you'll get a lot of people's experiences and warnings and great ideas. And so be in a group. If you go to, you know, SIA or NFG or Semantic Mastery or, you know, there's a ton of groups out there. They're all great, you know, but find one, you know, find your people. And then Fight Club. So if you want to see what I'm looking at recently, watch SEO Fight Club. We change the topic every week. We have a lot of diverse opinions on the matter. And tomorrow on Fight Club, we're going to be looking at local ranking factors that are unique to map search. And what's so interesting about the recent data we have on that is there seems to be about 2,000 of these ranking factors. And historically, people always said, well, it's proximity, it's the keyword in your business name, and maybe it's your rating and review count. But now that we're seeing real data on it, there's a lot more going on. So that's what we're talking about tomorrow.
Perfect. So if anyone's interested in that, obviously, SEO Fight Club on YouTube, you can watch Ted and all the SEOs there go through all that data as well. But thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate it. Learned a lot. I hope the listeners as well took a lot from that. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.